Good morning and welcome to the Minnesota Court of Appeals. This is it is October 1st, 2020, and this is the third case on our oral calendar this morning. Marshall, will you call the next case?
Judge Larkin and Judge Riley, the Honorable Judge Jessen presiding. Before the court is case A20-0294, Mark Moe versus Perham Stockyards, Inc.
Thank you. Let me just say a few things about our procedure this morning. This may be a little unusual, but format and Zoom versus .gov, but our procedure is very much the same as in our physical courtroom. Each party shall get 15 minutes for their oral argument, and counsel for appellant, you'll have an additional 5 minutes if you want to use it for rebuttal. I would ask you each to introduce yourself when you begin your argument, because we do have tapes that are publicly available. And also you'll note there's a timer in the corner of your screen. So we'll all be able quickly to assess how much time you have remaining. And with that, counsel for appellant, whenever you're ready.
Thank you, Your Honor. Can everybody hear me? Okay. John Mack, counsel for appellant. Mark Moe has a claim in both quasi-contract, contract implied in fact, and contract. Let me start with the issue of quasi-contract.
Mr. Mack, before you begin, you captioned the case as Mark Moe individually and as a partner in Moe Farms Partnership. And in your reply brief, you said that, this is on page 2, Mark Moe is not bringing his action on behalf of Moe Farm Partnership. He's just bringing it as an individual. Is that, I just want to make sure I know who you're representing and who's
I'm representing Mark Moe individually, and also what rights he has as a member of the now defunct partnership. He's not bringing it as a partnership action per se. And I think it may be useful for the court to take a look at MnStat 323A802, which is a partner's rights after the dissolution of a partnership.
Are you saying that's what gives him standing to sue individually?
Yes, he does have standing to sue individually.
Under that statute?
No, not under that statute. That's a statute which gives him it gives him the right to sue individually as a member of a now defunct partnership.
And can you point to any other authority for him to have standing to sue individually once the partnership has been dissolved?
I can point to this. I think he has an individual right, partnership or no partnership, to bring an action against Mitch for violation of his personal agreement with the Purim auction, because the promise was made to him as an individual not to hold the auction, and the promise was made to him as an individual to put his name on the check. Therefore, he has a right and standing to bring an action in contract and quasi-contract against Mr. Barthels and his corporation Purim auction. Now, Mark Moe had a right to have his name placed on the check anyway, because he was, at the time that this auction was held, a partner, even though it was undergoing dissolution. And the reason he had such a right is because partners have equal rights to veto or to assent to any action made with a third party, unless there is, for example, a managing partner. There was no such agreement. So he had as much right to agree to or disagree with the sale as his brother. And that was contravened by Mr. Barthels on behalf of Purim. If Mr. Barthels had honored his agreement, Mr. Barthels would not have been able to hold the auction at the time and place he did, and he would not have been able to be paid at the time and place and the amount that he was. And because Mr. Barthels did not honor his agreement to put Mark Moe's name on the check, he should not be permitted to keep the proceeds of the sale. Mark Moe was prejudiced because he would have been able to keep some of the proceeds, or at least for summary judgment purposes, He had enough evidence that he would have been able to keep part of the proceeds to survive summary judgment.
So, well, Mr. Mack,
I understand, excuse me, Judge Jessen, it's my understanding that the court dissolved the partnership because the two brothers weren't getting along, or I'm not sure what the background is, and that then the bank said you have to sell the cows, which are the collateral, and that the proceeds from that sale go to the bank to pay off the 2015 loan. And so I am wondering what damages did your client suffer specifically as an individual, when, as I understand it, the proceeds all would have gone to the bank.
And that's where I think this is incorrect, at least for summary judgment purposes. My client testified in his deposition that what normally would happen in a case like this, if he had been able to hold up the check, is that he would have negotiated with the creditor. I don't think it was the bank per se. And the typical thing that would happen in farm country is it would be compromised. The whole $5,000 wouldn't have gone to the creditor. He would have been able to get about $1,000, maybe $2,000 as an operating loan. And this is important for summary judgment purposes because the court doesn't necessarily have to believe this, but it isn't foreclosed. He's raised an issue of material fact, and therefore on that issue of material fact, he was damaged. How much he was damaged? Well, we hadn't gotten into that in great specificity yet because the summary judgment action was brought, I believe, before the close of discovery. Now, I'm sorry, does the court have a question?
So you're claiming there is this contract based on the messages that went back and forth.
Yes, that's what I'm claiming. I'm claiming that this both created a contract and worked in estoppel, basically a contract implied in fact, which is really a form of estoppel.
And so you think his request, please send a message back to confirm message.
Yes.
What is that? What part of a contract is that?
It's a contract to forego the auction. And it's a contract at the time. Obviously, at some point, the auction is going to get held.
But why isn't it just a confirmation that he received the message?
Pardon?
Why isn't it just a confirmation that he received the message?
Because I think that in the context of the back and forth between the two of them, it has to be read that he is agreeing not to do it, not to hold the auction at the time and place he holds the auction.
So, but Mr. Mack, my trouble is you can agree to do something if it's not a binding contract unless there's consideration. Where's the consideration here?
Well, the consideration is he could have stopped the sale because he had not agreed on behalf of the partnership to hold the auction at that particular time, and it wasn't ordered. I made a mistake, by the way, in my original, and I tried to correct it in my responsive brief, to the effect that the court did not order the auction. The court indicated that there might have to be an auction or a sale, but it didn't order it. So my client would have had the right to withhold his assent to the auction. And obviously that the consideration that he didn't exercise that right constituted valuable consideration. Now, as I indicated—
I just want to make sure you're not saying that the respondent in these text messages knew that, right?
Right.
I mean, you're saying this is something that was in the back of your client's mind at the time.
Well, or he had a reason
to
believe that.
Trying to get to the agreement. What?
Yeah. Yeah, based upon what Mr. Barthels was saying. Also, remember, it's very clear with regard to the promise to put his name on the check that Mr. Barthels agreed absolutely to that. The back and forth indicates that he will do that. And he doesn't tell my client that he's changed his mind. And that's important because if he tells my client he's changed his mind, I'd imagine my client at that point brings up 323A0301 and says, hey, you can't do this. And I don't know where Mr. Barthels got the idea that he didn't have to tell my client at least that he was changing his mind. Now, as I indicated.
I'm just trying to understand where you're saying respondent agreed to put your client's name on the check.
Yes.
Is it in that?
It's in my brief, and it's also in the deposition.
No, I'm not talking about the deposition. I'm talking about that message that I read the last part of earlier. Please confirm, send a message back to confirm message. And then respondent goes, yes, no problem. Are you saying that's where he agreed not to, or agreed to put your client's name on the check? I'm just trying to understand your understanding of the record.
Yes,
and don't get to deposition. I want to see something in writing that went back and forth between them.
Yes, I'm contending that that was in fact an agreement. And of course, you don't have to put things in writing anymore. You can email them.
And I'll accept that it's as what you say, that how this contract was formed and what the terms of the contract were. But yes. Then going to Judge Jessen's question, where is the consideration in that?
Well, consideration can be negative consideration. And in this case, the negative consideration is that my client would not, for example, hold up the auction, would not hold up his proceeds, and would not follow up the ability to negotiate the check. So all of those things are what we sometimes call negative consideration, but negative consideration is consideration to forego a known right. Mark Moe has an action in contract, a straight contract as well. First of all, Mr. Barthels agreed and Mr. Moe both agreed that an auction would not be held at the time and date indicated, and that Mark Moe's name would be placed on the contract. As I say, a request to forbear is an offer. There was an acceptance in the form of a promise, and the agreement was not unlawful. I think that the equitable issue probably should be brought up at this time. My client, as he indicated in his deposition, wasn't able to attend the Barthels auction because his child was being born that same day and that had priority. Otherwise, he would have done it. But he was damaged, first of all, because he wasn't able to negotiate with the creditor, or for that matter, Mr. Barthels, as to what would happen with that check. He had a right as a partner to have his name placed on that check. And Mr. Barthels, quite frankly, disobeyed partnership law by putting only the name of his brother Matthew on the check. There's an equitable issue here, and I think it's very important to look at it. My client has every reason to think his name is going to be on that check. He takes no action, therefore. And as a result of it, he is simply prejudiced because Mr. Barthels didn't keep his word. Mr. Barthels didn't clarify anything. Mr. Barthels didn't indicate that he changed his mind. So he kept my client from taking action because this is so.
Mr. Mack, if I may, but why is it inequitable for respondent to get to keep a commission that it seems like everyone agrees it earned the commission?
Well, he wouldn't have earned the commission.
Part of our analysis?
I'm sorry. He wouldn't have earned the commission if he held an unlawful auction, or if he held the auction in defiance of what he had promised to do. And what he had promised to do was to put my client's name on the auction. And therefore, he shouldn't be able to keep, if not the whole 5,000, at least should only be able to keep the portion of the $5,000, which would be reduced by the amount that my client would otherwise have been able to negotiate with the bank.
But you understand the record better than I do, but I thought here there was agreement that the cattle needed to be auctioned. They're going to need, and so someone's going to earn a commission on someone's that auction, right?
They have the right to a commission. What they don't have the right to do, though, is to take the entire commission when my client should have been entitled to some of the proceeds of the check. I think we're on a different wavelength now. If he held an auction in breach of a contract, or he held a contract held an auction in breach of partnership law, then he should not be able to keep all the proceeds because he held an illegal auction.
I thought we were talking about your quasi-contract claim here, and that where we do look at the equities, correct?
Yes. Yes, we do look at equity and quasi-contract.
So, Mr. Mack, I could not find a copy of the auction check in the record. You talk about it. I don't know how much it was. I don't know whose name was on the back. I don't know anything about it. Can you point me to the record where a copy of that check is?
I believe it is part of the transcript of my client's deposition. I think that the...
But is there a copy of the actual check in the record?
I think there is, but I can't on short notice produce it.
Well, maybe during Mr. Strand's argument, you can look for it.
Sure. Okay, I think my time's up.
Thank you. Mr. Strand, we'll turn to you.
Good morning, Scott Strand for Respondent, Perham Stockyard, Inc. I'd just like to clarify something that Mr. Mack said and also answer the court's question about the auction draft. It is Exhibit G to our motion for summary judgment. Mr. Mack, I believe, mentioned that Perham Stockyards made the draft payable only to the brother, Matt Moe. That's not true. It was payable to the partnership as the owner of the cattle and CHS as the security interest holder in the cattle. That's who the auction draft was payable to. To start with, justices, in summary, there can be no claims from an improper or illegal auction, because what happened was exactly what was supposed to happen. In the respondent's motion for summary judgment, we included as Exhibit A the findings of fact, conclusions of law, and the order from the partnership dissolution action. These findings included 6 very relevant facts to the issue before the court here. Number one, the partnership owned the cattle. Nobody owned the cattle individually, the partnership owned the cattle. 2, CHS had a security interest in the cattle. 3, the partnership defaulted on the CHS loan. 4, CHS required liquidation of the cattle. 5, sale of the cattle at auction was necessary. And 6, neither party, which includes the appellant, contested the auction proceeds or application of the proceeds to the CHS debt. These findings of fact, I believe, are in conflict with the argument that this auction was illegal or improper.
And just let me make sure that I understand the time frame. As I understand it, in December of 2016, the partnership received notice from CHS that it had defaulted. In January of 2017, CHS required the liquidation of the assets to satisfy the debt. The auction, the cows were sold a month later, February 2017. And then it was over a year later in August of 2018 that Moe Farms was dissolved by judicial decree. And those are the findings that you're talking about now. Is that the timeline?
I don't have the order directly, but that's my recollection of the timeline.
Okay, but that's the order of things.
I believe so.
And then it was in April of 2019 that appellant brought this suit.
Yes. If we could turn to, I believe my understanding of the importance of the arguments. The appellant argues that there was a quasi-contract claim. As you know, in Minnesota, a quasi-contract claim requires 2 things. One, you have to have unjust enrichment. That isn't present here. The only enrichment here that Perham Stockyards could possibly have received was the $5,000 charge for holding the auction. there's nothing unjust about this. As the district court noted in the partnership dissolution action, the auction was necessary. The cattle had to be sold at auction in order to satisfy the CHS debt. So Perham Stockyards didn't receive anything unjustly, it performed a service. Even if these findings of fact didn't exist, Minnesota law has said unjust enrichment requires a benefit be conferred by the plaintiff onto the defendant, the defendant accept the benefit, the defendant retain the benefit without payment is inequitable. But those facts aren't present here. Perham Stockyards sold the cattle and performed a service and is entitled to keep. The second element of unjust enrichment is it comes at the plaintiff's expense. And here's where we go back to, I believe, one of the first questions to Mr. Mack. The partnership is not bringing this claim. The partnership owned the cattle. So any unjust enrichment, if there were any, and I don't think there are, would come at the expense of the partnership, not appellant individually. So the unjust enrichment claim, I believe, fails. Next, moving on to the contract claim. I think the court, district court, got it correct. There is no contract. We don't have sufficient evidence to prove that there's a contract here. Even if there were, if we go back to the district court order on the partnership dissolution, the auction had to happen. Regardless of what the appellant wanted, the auction had to happen to satisfy this debt. I believe what appellant is suggesting is the auction went forward because he allowed it to, right? He said, put my name on the check, and now the auction can go forward. But that misses the point. The appellant didn't have that power. The auction had to go forward. The partnership defaulted on the debt, CHS had a security loan, and required liquidation of the partnership property. And so that was my point in the respondent brief. Individually, he had nothing to offer. This auction was going to take place. I'd like to spend a couple minutes on the damages issue as well. First, the appellant claims you incurred a tax liability because the cattle were sold. In doing so, in his principal brief, he argues he would not have incurred this liability if, number one, the cattle had not been sold, or number two, the cattle had been sold, but his name had been individually included on the check. There are two very big problems with this argument. First, the cattle had to be sold. The district court in the partnership dissolution action found that it had to be sold, it was necessary. Significantly, we've raised this point a number of times throughout this action, and appellant has produced no evidence to the contrary, no evidence that this cattle did not have to be sold. Second, the appellant's name was not included on the check. He didn't own the cattle. The partnership owned the cattle. The other issue I have with the tax liability damages claim, I don't pretend to be a tax expert, but one thing that has never made sense to me and that appellant has never explained, how does the appellant have a tax liability on the sale if CHS received the settlement proceeds? Which leads me to, the appellant has produced no evidence in support of his tax liability claim. He alleged these damages in the complaint, so presumably at that time, he had some semblance of what this tax liability was, right? We asked for evidence in written discovery. Appellant produced no evidence of this tax liability. We moved for summary judgment. Appellant produced no evidence of this tax liability. In his principal brief on appeal, the appellant argues there was still time to produce this because expert disclosure had not closed. That's not true. As we pointed out in our brief, expert disclosures closed before appellant responded to our motion for summary judgment. Additionally, discovery had closed. Certainly upon moving for summary judgment, that's the time to produce the evidence, right? None was produced. The next element of damages, the auction fee. Here, appellant argues that the respondent was unjustly enriched because of the auction fee. Again, there's no unjust enrichment. Perham Stockyards performed a valuable service, a service which the district court in the partnership dissolution action found was necessary. Additionally, any claim for recovery of this auction fee would be held by the partnership, not the appellant individually. Third, and there was some discussion on this, at the district court level, less so at the appellate level, but I'd like to just touch on it. There's been a suggestion that the cattle was sold for less than fair market value, but the appellant had the opportunity to contest this amount in the partnership dissolution action. He did not. The district court in that action found no one contested the auction proceeds and no one contested application of these proceeds to the CHS operating loan. What happened was exactly what was supposed to happen. Assuming he could now contest these proceeds, we requested evidence in the original action. What evidence do you have that the cattle was sold at less than fair market value? He produced none. We moved for summary judgment. He produced none. Finally, any claim that the cattle sold for less than fair market value would be held by the partnership and not the appellant individually. So I think the primary argument that the appellant has is essentially, look, my name wasn't included on this check, and it shouldn't have been. He didn't own the cattle. But there's been this suggestion that had his name been included on that check, he would have been able to negotiate with CHS. He would have had some leverage over CHS, and that sort of that's just how this is done, right? I don't know if that is how it is done or not, but no evidence has been produced. I know the appellant testified that's how it's done. But if it is, it probably shouldn't be how it's done. He didn't own that cattle. The partnership owned the cattle. CHS had a security interest far greater than what that cattle was worth, far greater than what it sold for. So again, going back to my initial statement, what happened was exactly what was supposed to happen. And unless there's any questions from the court, I don't believe I have anything further.
Thank you, Mr. Strand. Mr. Mack, we'll turn to you for any rebuttal. Mr. Mack, I believe you're still muted.
Go back to the check, which is Exhibit G now that we found. And it was not simply the case that the name on the check was the partnership. It was also Matthew Moe and a number of other persons involved. So Purim Auctions, through Mr. Barthels, knew that a necessary party to that check was Mark Moe. I think it's useful to think about the consequences of the fact that all those names were on it, except my clients. That's a recognition that somebody had to sign on an individual capacity as well as the partnership capacity, and that would have been my client. Now, I think that there's a slight mistake that Mr. Strand is making when he says that the court ordered the cattle to be sold at auction. No, the court didn't do that. It said it probably would have to be sold in some manner, but it didn't indicate the nature of the sale. It didn't indicate who was to make the sale or the terms of the sale. And I made that mistake too.
We have the partnership dissolution order, and one of the findings of fact that Mr. Strand referenced was that no one objected to that sale or the amount.
Well, I think the question there is that sale. And I think he doesn't have to make the objection in the partnership action because he has an individual action for the reasons that I indicated earlier against Purim Auction. Note that you don't have to have the cattle particularly sold in a specific way, but if you prejudice an individual by holding an illegal sale, that issue is not going to be brought up in the partnership agreement or in the partnership dissolution action because Mr. Barthels and Purim Auction are not parties to it. And I doubt if they could even have been joined as parties if in fact that had been the case. Thank you.
Thank you both for the arguments and briefing. We'll take the matter under advisement and a decision will be issued within 90 days. And with that, we are ending our oral arguments this morning.